So how did you do this year? Did you make it all week without eating any leaven? I remember a couple of years back, I was traveling out of town for work during the days of unleavened bread, and I stopped for lunch at a Taco Bell. Very nutritious, I know, but I thought, hey, it's unleavened bread. I'll get some tacos and everything will be fine. Went through the drive-thru, got my tacos, drove off. Yes, I was planning to eat the tacos while I was driving. As I got down the road a good ways, I opened the bag up and I started looking at it. And I realized that they had given me some soft tacos made with flour tortillas, which we all know are leavened. I thought to myself, okay, it's an honest mistake. Somewhere there was a mix-up between me and the person that took my order. I happened to be driving through an area where there's usually a lot of people panhandling along the roadside. So I just decided to myself, I'll just give these tacos to someone standing on the side of the road. Pawn my sin off on someone else. I drove around for quite a while, actually, hitting all of those corners where there's usually somebody standing there. And I did not find one single person. Not one. So I'm driving along the road here, occasionally casting glances at this bag of sin, riding shotgun with me. Couldn't find anyone to take it. So I ended up just having to stop somewhere and throw those soft tacos away. Now, hopefully nothing like that happened to you this week. I would imagine that everyone here today did a very good job of keeping the leaven out of our homes, our cars, out of our lives in general. And likewise, I hope we gave the same critical attention to sin, that we diligently focus on keeping the sin out of our lives as well. But as we near the end of the days of unleavened bread, now what? One thing that I love about the spring festivals is that there's so much symbolism involved. We're given very simple and straightforward instructions, yet these days contain very powerful lessons for us to learn. I want to touch on one aspect of this today, a lesson that we can apply to ourselves as we wrap up the days of unleavened bread this year. In many cases, when a servant of God does a powerful work, now it's God's work through that servant, but in many cases, right after that work is accomplished, that is when Satan attacks. We're on this high, and then Satan comes along and tries to bring us down low. Right after those moments of success, we have to keep our guard up, because that's when the attacks come. He's always attacking, don't get me wrong, but I think you'd probably agree with me. It's a much more concentrated attack right after those moments of success. We've gone all week with keeping leaven out of our lives. We've kept the sin out. But as the sun sets tonight, we cannot allow it, our guard to be let down. Once the days of unleavened bread are completed, we may decide to bring some leaven back in the house, and that's okay. It's a different matter with sin, though. We have to continue to resist. As Mr. Hammer reminded us on the first holy day, we are engaged in a lifelong battle against sin. As I think about this concept of being on a high, successfully accomplishing a work, and then being caught off guard by Satan, there's a couple of individuals that come to my mind. We'll look at those today. They're actually both recorded in the book of Kings. Let's begin by turning over to 1 Kings chapter 16. I want to bring our attention to one of the evil kings of Israel. You hear the name King Ahab, and you automatically think of a very bad man. But let's read how he's described in Scripture. 1 Kings chapter 16, beginning in verse 29. 1 Kings 16:29. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, the son of Omri, became king over Israel. And Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel and Samaria 22 years. Now, Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord, more than all who were before him. 31. And it came to pass, as though it had been a trivial thing for him, to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, that he took his wife Jezebel, the son of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. And he went and served Baal and worshipped him. So what does this passage tell us about King Ahab? Well, in verse 30, we're told that he did evil in the sight of the Lord, more than all the kings before him. That's a significant statement that's made there. More evil than all of the kings before him. So this includes Omri, who it says walked in sin, provoking the Lord to anger because of his idols. This includes Zimri, who was a murderous and treacherous man. He conspired against the previous king, and basically stole the throne from him through acts of violence. The same goes for Baasa, Nadab, the list goes on. If you want to study it sometime, their accounts are recorded in a couple of previous chapters before this one. Let's go back up to verse 31 again. Read it one more time. Speaking of King Ahab, "And it came to pass, as though it had been a trivial thing, for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam." In other words, it wasn't a very big deal to him. It was a trivial thing to rule the nation through evil intentions and with an evil heart. That was not a big deal to King Ahab. That's the kind of person that he was. It mentions the sins of Jeroboam, and we'll actually get to him a bit later. Right now, let's just keep our focus on the wickedness of King Ahab. Turn over to chapter 21 with me. 1 Kings chapter 21. We'll just read one verse out of this chapter, but it serves as a summary statement for the life of King Ahab. 1 Kings 21, verse 25. 1 Kings 21, 25. "But there was no one like Ahab, who sold himself to do wickedness in the sight of the Lord, because Jezebel, his wife, stirred him up." As I said, that's a pretty good summary of King Ahab as to the kind of ruler, the kind of person that he was. I want to go back to chapter 17 now. Now that we have an introduction to the wickedness of King Ahab, let's bring another individual into the story. 1 Kings chapter 17, we'll begin in the first verse. 1 Kings 17, verse 1. "And Elijah the Tishbite of the inhabitants of Gilead said to Ahab, 'As the Lord God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years, except at my word.'" That most certainly took some courage, to stand before this evil king, a man that was more evil than all of the ones before him. Make no mistake about it. They were bad men. And yet, Ahab was worse than any of them. This does not deter Elijah. He stands before Ahab and he tells him, "You need to realize that you're not going to see a drop of rain except at my word," which we know came from God. He was God's prophet, but that took some courage for Elijah to do that. And there's no indication of him backing down from Ahab. His words to Ahab were fulfilled. There were no rain. There was no rain for years. And that was a success for the prophet Elijah. Just as God said it would, that's what happened. Continuing in chapter 18. Let's go to 18, picking it up in verse 1. 1 Kings 18, 1. This will have been years later. Continuing on with the account. "And it came to pass after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, 'Go, present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the earth.' So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab, and there was a severe famine in Samaria. And Ahab called Obadiah, who was in charge of his house." Now, Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. So we've got the same confidence here with Elijah as before. No fear of standing before this evil king that was reigning over Israel. King Ahab sends Obadiah out in search of water, and while he's on his way, Obadiah comes across Elijah. Drop down in verse 7. "Now as Obadiah was on his way, suddenly Elijah met him, and he recognized him and fell on his face and said, "Is that you, my lord Elijah?" And he answered him, "It is I. Go tell your master, Elijah is here." The next few verses are dialogue between these two individuals. We won't read all of it, but it does further emphasize the kind of person that King Ahab was. There's some real expressions of fear on the part of Obadiah here. He was convinced that King Ahab was going to kill him if he showed back up hand in hand with Elijah. I touched on that earlier. Ahab was an evil king, murderous and idolatrous, more than any other king before him. And yet that did not prevent Elijah from continuing on with his duty. 15. "Then Elijah said, 'As the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely present myself to him today.' So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. Then it happened, when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said to him, 'Is that you, O troubler of Israel?' 18. And he answered, 'I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, in that you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and have followed the Baals. Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me on Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table.'" During their first encounter, Elijah left on a high note. A successful work was accomplished. I want to keep emphasizing that. He boldly proclaimed before King Ahab that no rain was going to come. And that prophetic statement was fulfilled. Now, it was God's word spoken through Elijah, of course, but the fact remains, Elijah was used as part of that work. It was a successful mission. I think we're very familiar with the remainder of the account, so I'm just going to summarize it briefly. We essentially have a competition. The prophets of Baal have an offering. Elijah has an offering. And they were both praying for fire to come down to consume the offering. Whichever offering was burned up by fire would win the competition. Of course, we know that Elijah's God, our God, won that competition. He defeated the prophets of Baal. He called down fire from heaven and it consumed everything. But it didn't stop there. Continuing on in verse 40. 1 Kings 18:40. "And Elijah said to him, 'Seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape.' So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to Brook Kishon and executed them there." This points out to us that Elijah was bold. After all, we know how King Ahab behaved. And yet Elijah served the Lord powerfully. No fear. This was a successful work that had been accomplished. Here we are on the last day of unleavened bread, and that's the parallel that I'm trying to make here. We've gone through this Feast of Unleavened Bread, winning the battle against sin, keeping sin completely out, just like Elijah. It's been a successful work. We're on a spiritual high right now. There's been an intense focus on staying close to God and on keeping the sin out. But we cannot stop. We can't let our guard down. When you really consider what was accomplished through the life of Elijah, we've narrowly focused on just one part of his life, but when you reflect upon these things, it's really amazing to speak boldly before King Ahab like that, to call down fire from heaven, to remove the prophets of Baal and their influence on the people. All of those things were accomplished by God through Elijah. That's an important detail that Elijah momentarily forgot. He was on this high, but that's when the attack really came. Let's go to chapter 19, 1 Kings 19. God accomplished all of those things through his prophet Elijah. He was a faithful and brave man. But after those high-profile accomplishments, he lets his guard down for just a moment. 1 Kings 19:1. "And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done regarding all the prophets of Baal, also how he had executed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, 'So let the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow at this time.' And when he saw that, he arose and ran for his life and went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. Verse 4, but he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he prayed that he might die and said, it is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's. I think we sometimes laugh at this, the fact that God accomplished so much through the life of Elijah. He was so faithful, successful, and bold. Then all of a sudden, at the name of Jezebel, he completely melts with fear and begins doubting, seriously doubting God. I think it's easy for me to point the finger at Elijah, but what about myself? How about you? Do we ever doubt God? During the days of unleavened bread, we have an intense focus on keeping the sin out. But that's just 7 days, and 2 of those days are holy days. You might say that's fertile soil for a successful mission. What about beyond today, though? Maybe we're not threatened to be chased down by Jezebel, but we do have our trials, don't we? We have to be sure that we're prepared for that coordinated attack that's coming. When we're in the throes of that battle, will we allow doubt to creep in? Or will we trust that God is with us, that he's helping us to fight that battle against sin? Let's go over to the book of James, chapter 1. Where does the inclination to doubt even come from? James chapter 1. I believe we can trace it all the way back to the Garden of Eden, where the serpent planted that seed of doubt in Eve's mind. Has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? Are you sure that's what he said? Because I don't think so. Satan planted that seed of doubt, and if he used it against Eve, then he's going to use it against us too. James chapter 1, verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Verse 5. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting. For he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all of his ways. When Elijah faced this trial, when he was threatened to be hunted down by Jezebel, he doubted God. And there's some real application there for us. We won't turn there, I'll just reference it, but in chapter 5 of James, James 5:17, it talks about how Elijah was a man just like us. He had a nature just like us. So the things that he went through internally, we too can go through those things. We can react in the same manner that he did. Notice what we read in verse 6 there. When we go through our trials, we need to remain faithful to God. Without doubting. Again, it ties in with what we read about Elijah. Jezebel was a nasty woman, and being chased by her would certainly qualify as a trial. Although we can empathize with how Elijah might have felt, and we may understand the reasons why he reacted that way. When we're facing our own trials, we have to resist the temptation to fall into that pattern of thinking. As we wrap up the days of unleavened bread and face those trials that are set before us, will we ever doubt that God is with us? To again reference back to our battle against sin, will we ever reach that point where we feel all alone, doubting that God is there for us? I hope not, but that is a tool that Satan uses to attack us, doubt. As we go through our trials, there's potential for us to allow that mindset to creep in, just like what we read from Elijah's account. Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians 6. God is with us. And he equips us with the tools that we need to fight this battle against sin. Ephesians chapter 6. We've just spent 7 days of intense diligence in keeping the sin out. Let's take a moment to look beyond these 7 days, though. We've had a successful mission. We've accomplished this work. But that's when we have to be careful not to let our guard down. Ephesians 6, verse 10. Ephesians 6:10. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Right up front, we're instructed to lean on God. Be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. It's not our might, it's His might. Verse 11. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. The Greek word methodia is what's translated there as the wiles of the devil. It's his methods, the tactics that he uses against us. One of those methods is to cause us to doubt. Verse 12, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. I can't help but be reminded of Elijah facing off against evil King Ahab and the hundreds and hundreds of prophets of Baal. Wickedness, sin, that's what we're battling. And how do we fight against it? Verse 13, therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. The purpose of the armor is to protect ourselves while we're in battle. I think we understand that. I won't belabor the point. Just want to emphasize that those are the tools that God does provide to us. And the purpose of these tools is to stand against the wiles of the devil. Symbolically speaking, Elijah momentarily took the armor off. He was strong in the Lord. He was wearing that armor in battle, accomplishing so much, and yet he symbolically took the armor off just long enough to let doubt begin to creep in. Elijah had a nature just like we do, so it's something that we have to guard against as well. Doubting is a device, a wile of Satan the devil. We can't forget that. As we go beyond the days of unleavened bread, remember that we're not alone in this battle against sin. Never doubt that God is with us. We can find strength in this battle through Him, as we just read out of Ephesians 6. Be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. He gives us the strength that we need. And it's described as armor that we wear in the battle. It can help us fight against many things. But so far we've just touched on doubt. So we've addressed doubt. I'd like to transition now to another tactic that's used by our adversary, something that we need to be mindful of and on guard against as we look beyond the days of unleavened bread. We've had an intense focus throughout this week. It's been a successful week, keeping the leaven out, but we can't let up now. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 12. As I said, both accounts were in Kings. Let's go to 1 Kings 12. Look at another wile of the devil, deceitfulness. 1 Kings 12. Earlier we talked about how King Ahab was evil and walked in the sins of Jeroboam. He followed his example. That's what it means. Well, here in chapter 12, we have Jeroboam himself. So it's going to be going back down the timeline a little bit. The idolatrous king of Israel, Jeroboam. 1 Kings 12, picking it up in verse 25. After the death of Solomon, the kingdom of Israel split in two. You've got Rehoboam ruling over Judah, and then Jeroboam ruling over the rest of Israel. Just going to follow the path taken by Jeroboam to show us what kind of person he was. Verse 25. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. Also, he went out from there and built Peniel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, Now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Right up front, we see that he was a selfish person. He made choices in regards to leadership based upon retaining power and control. He didn't want these people uniting again under the leadership of Rehoboam. But it goes beyond just selfishness. Continuing on in verse 28. Therefore the king asked advice, made two calves of gold, and said to the people, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt." And he set one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. I really want to emphasize verse 30, though. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. So Jeroboam caused the people to sin. He goes on to make people priests who had no business being priests. I wonder if that decision might have been about retaining power as well. Listen, if you keep me in power, go ahead and make yourself priest. I don't care. That's verse 31. You made priests from every class of people who were not the sons of Levi. That's in defiance of the instruction that God had given. But wait, there's more. He goes on to change the calendar. And he basically just sets up a false religion. That's recorded in verses 32 and 33. Changes the feast days. With that as a backdrop, we're introduced to the next person that I want to focus on, chapter 13. 1 Kings 13, it's an unnamed individual who's simply referred to as a man of God. And he's about to go before this evil King Jeroboam. 1 Kings 13, verse 1. There's a reason why I bring all of this up. Don't want to lose sight of that. When we have moments of success where accomplishments have been made, that's when we really need to be on guard against attack. It happened with Elijah, and it's about to happen with this man of God. Let's not get ahead of ourselves just yet. Just keep that in mind. 1 Kings 13, verse 1. And behold, a man of God went from Judah to Bethel by the word of the Lord, and Jeroboam stood by the altar to burn incense. Then he cried out against the altar by the word of the Lord and said, "O altar, altar, thus says the Lord, behold, a child, Josiah by name, shall be born to the house of David. And on you he shall sacrifice the priests of the high places who burn incense on you, and men's bones shall be burned on you." And he gave a sign the same day, saying, "This is the sign which the Lord has spoken. Surely the altar shall split apart, and the ashes on it shall be poured out." Not exactly the news that Jeroboam wanted to hear. As you might expect, this was a hostile work environment for the man of God. He was standing before someone that did not want him there, telling him things that he did not want to hear. Very similar situation to Elijah facing King Ahab. Verse 4. So it came to pass when King Jeroboam heard the saying of the man of God, who cried out against the altar in Bethel, that he stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, "Arrest him." Then his hand, which he stretched out toward him, withered so that he could not pull it back to himself. As we read through these events, keep in mind the successful mission that's being accomplished here. Just like Elijah saying that there would be no rain, and there was no rain. Same situation here. The words from the man of God, words that he received from the Lord, they're being fulfilled before their very eyes. Continuing on in verse 5. The altar also was split apart, and the ashes poured out from the altar, according to the sign which the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. Then the king answered and said to the man of God, we have a change of attitude here clearly, "Please entreat the favor of the Lord your God, and pray for me, that my hand may be restored to me." So the man of God entreated the Lord, and the king's hand was restored to him, and became as before. don't overlook who the man of God is speaking to here. He's addressing the sinful king of Israel, Jeroboam, with confidence and boldness. There's an intense focus on the matter at hand. The king wants to bring him home and reward the man for restoring his hand, but he politely declines down in verse 8. But the man of God said to the king, "If you were to give me half your house, I would not go in with you. Nor would I eat bread nor drink water in this place. For so it was commanded me by the word of the Lord, saying, 'You shall not eat bread nor drink water, nor return by the same way you came.' So he went another way and did not return by the way he came to Bethel." If that's all there was to it, we'd certainly have a happy ending to this account. He did just what God had told him to do. And this man is leaving town on a high. There's been a successful work accomplished. But I think we all realize that's not the whole story. Unfortunately, he does let his guard down. On his way home, this man comes across an old prophet who's very persuasive and also very deceptive. In verse 15, the old prophet wants the man of God to come home with him. Then he said to him, "Come home with me and eat bread." Once again, he declines the offer, stating that the word of the Lord commanded him not to do this thing. Don't stop and eat bread. Don't stop and drink water. He's coming off of this victory with Jeroboam, where he was bold and confident, trusting the instructions that he was given. But he's about to be brought very low. He's about to be deceived. Verse 18, he said to him, "I too am a prophet, as you are." This is the lying prophet speaking to him here. "And an angel spoke to me by the word of the Lord, saying, 'Bring him back with you to your house, that he may eat bread and drink water.'" He was lying to him. So he went back with him and ate bread in his house and drank water. You know, we have the luxury of that parenthetical statement in verse 18. He was lying to him. The man of God didn't have that information, or at least it wasn't presented to him in the way that it's presented to us. This lying prophet didn't come up to this man of God and confess, "You know, I'm lying to you." That's not what happened. But the point is, he was deceived. He was tricked. The consequence of him being deceived was the loss of his life. Let's finish out the story and then we'll bring out the lesson in all of this. Verse 20. "Now it happened as they sat at the table that the word of the Lord came to the prophet who had brought him back, and he cried out to the man of God who came from Judah, saying, 'Thus says the Lord, because you have disobeyed the word of the Lord and have not kept the commandment which the Lord your God commanded you, but you came back, ate bread, and drank water in the place of which the Lord said, eat no bread and drink no water. Your corpse shall not come to the tomb of your fathers.'" In the next few verses, these words are fulfilled, and the man of God loses his life. Verse 26. "Now when the prophet who had brought him back from the way heard it, he said, 'It is the man of God who was disobedient to the word of the Lord. Therefore the Lord had delivered him to the lion, which has torn him and killed him, according to the word of the Lord which spoke to him.'" This is where I want to circle back around to us here today on the last day of unleavened bread. This man had literally just completed a great work in the presence of Jeroboam. God's work through him, to be sure. It was a great accomplishment. But the man of God lets his guard down, and he falls for the deception, the deceitfulness of this lying prophet. He initially resisted, I'll give him that, but he was ultimately deceived. It's the same pattern as before. A successful accomplish takes place, which is then followed by a coordinated attack, trying to catch him off guard, which he was. In this case, there's also some wearing down involved. The man of God initially did the right thing and said no. This is contradictory to what God had told me. But the lying prophet's persistent, kept trying to deceive, and ultimately was able to do so. The takeaway for us here is to maintain our diligence. The attack is coming. Don't get caught off guard. Recognize that deception is out there. Understand the power of sin's influence and the ability that sin has to deceive us. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 5. It's a verse we always go to during these days. In fact, we read it this morning. So, Mr. Flynn, one of your verses was taken, one of mine was taken too. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Repetition's not always a bad thing. Let's read it again. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 6. 1 Corinthians 5, 6. Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. Every time I read verse 6, I think about the old book, Flowers for Algernon. Anyone ever read that, Flowers for Algernon? I think it was written in the late 1950s. They made a movie about it, too. It was produced sometime in the 1960s. I recall watching that movie many years ago. Anyway, the main character works in a bakery, and he gets bullied by his coworkers quite a bit. And in one of those scenes, they actually fill his locker with dough. And that dough sits in there, quietly fermenting, constantly rising and expanding, until his locker's just bursting at the seams. Dough going everywhere, making a huge mess for the poor guy. But that's the idea here. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. It doesn't take much sin to contaminate the entire lump. That's the lesson this verse is getting across. Purge out the leaven that you may be a new lump, a pure, unleavened lump, containing no sin whatsoever. This is describing the process that we've gone through and the progress that we've made. We're a new lump, having no leaven, no sin. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Let's go there next. Paul's writing to the Corinthian church, and the topic at hand is remaining faithful to the truth. It was a concern for the Apostle Paul that they remain faithful. I want to begin in verse 1. We'll read through verse 4. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 1. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 1. Oh, that you would bear with me in a little folly. And indeed you do bear with me, for I am jealous for you with godly jealousy. For I have betrothed you to one husband, that I might present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. But I fear lest somehow, as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ. For if he who comes preaches another Jesus, whom we have not preached, or if you receive a different spirit, which you have not received, or a different gospel, which you have not accepted, you may well put up with it. Verse 2. This is a part of being that new lump. We've been betrothed to one husband, presented as a chaste virgin to Christ. That's a similar idea as being described as unleavened, a chaste virgin, faithful to one husband, having not been defiled. Verse 3 is talking about deception and the significance of protecting our mind. We truly are unleavened, a new lump. No contamination, no sin. In order to keep it that way, we cannot allow our minds to be corrupted. Two aspects that we've focused on today, doubt and deceit, they were both there in the Garden of Eden with the serpent and with Eve. He deceived her into doubting that God was really telling her the truth. And he is so good at deceiving. He's the father of lies, after all, a liar from the beginning. That's why we have to continually focus on this battle that we're fighting, this battle against the influence of Satan, the battle against sin. If we let our guard down, that's when he's going to get us. I'm not presenting the idea that we should live in fear, frightened of Satan's attacks. That's not what I'm saying. But in order to stand against the wiles of the devil, we have to know what his methods are. We can't fight a battle against something when we don't know what it is. I've talked a lot about being on guard, not allowing our level of commitment to drop off after achieving a moment of success. How do we do that, though? Do you have any scriptures that immediately come to your mind? How about Ephesians 4? Let's go to Ephesians 4. We don't want our minds corrupted. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. The smallest trace of sin has the potential to infect the whole thing. Toss a little doubt into our mind. What's going to happen? Same with deceit. Doesn't take much to have a real negative impact. Ephesians 4. I was talking about this with my family this past week as to the way that Satan attacks our mind. A simple analogy that we discussed was it's as if we have a wall surrounding our mind, protecting it from Satan's attack. Now, we can just open the front gate and let him walk right in without putting much of a fight up at all. But even if we keep the gate closed, he wants to find a way over that wall. More on that in just a moment. Ephesians 4, verses 17 through 19, talk about how our behavior should be different from those who are walking in darkness and blindness of heart. Verse 20, let's read verse 20. Ephesians 4, 20. But you have not so learned Christ, if indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him, as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. Reminds us of what we read in Corinthians. Purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump. Verse 23. And be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man, which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. Again, this is the idea of being a chaste virgin presented to Christ without contamination, true righteousness and holiness. Continuing in verse 25. Therefore, putting away lying, let each one of you speak truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. I want to pay close attention to verse 27. Going back to our analogy of a wall surrounding our mind, protecting it from the attacks of Satan the devil. We may have the gate closed, but he's still trying to find a way inside. Both the New Living Translation and the New International Version use the word foothold in verse 27. The NIV says, do not give the devil a foothold. New Living Translation says, anger gives the devil a foothold. And that's the context of this verse, specifically speaking of anger. But it's my opinion that you could apply many of these things to that same principle. It doesn't take much contamination to make a real negative impact. If we won't open the front gate, then Satan's going to try and climb the wall. We don't want to provide him with a foothold that will assist him in climbing over the wall. We want to keep him out. We want to remain unleavened in righteousness and holiness. We saw the results of Elijah when he allowed doubt to scale the wall and begin creeping in. It changed his outlook and his perspective, not in a good way. We saw the results of the man of God when he was deceived. In both of those cases, they were coming off of some very successful missions. Each man mightily accomplished what God had sent him to do. They bravely stood before evil kings that were very powerful men. But as they let their guard down, it gave place to the devil. They provided him with a foothold, which allowed just enough room for the influence that he desired. As we close out the remainder of this feast, we should look back upon the lessons of this week, the purpose for the days of unleavened bread. We've accomplished what we've been commanded to accomplish. We've kept the leaven out. But as the sun sets tonight, we cannot stop. The battle continues. physical leaven products will no doubt make it back into our homes at some point, but the goal is to continue keeping sin out. Regardless of whatever methods are used against us, our responsibility is to put on the new man, which was created according to God, in true righteousness and holiness.